It's you that I love.
Are the Monkees and I Know What I Know. Good morning, Rachel Teat. How are we?
I'm good, thank you. Excellent. Happy New Year, everyone.
Precisely, January the 4th. Motoring on through like a tremendous sort of jaunt into 2019, which is where we are. And in a few moments' time, we'll be celebrating the New Year with TV psychologist Donna Dawson, who'll be talking about how we can keep our New Year resolutions. And Donna pretty much knows what she's talking about. As you'd expect, really, because at the end of the day, she wouldn't be on Southside Broadcasting if she didn't know what she was talking about. Following up from Donna Dawson, we'll also be speaking to Chris Hollins, I believe you're aware of.
I'm well aware of, after his amazing Strictly performance a few years ago.
Wonderful. That's, yep. We've also got, I think, footballer Mark Hill joining us. Harry Wallop, consumer affairs soul, will be talking about Sunshine Saturday, which apparently is tomorrow. Oh, it's amazing. That's, of course, if you're listening to this live on Channel 1 for Hospedia at the James Cook University Hospital. If you're not listening via podcast, it's probably already been and gone.
Oh, no.
Or it might be tomorrow. I don't know. We'll see what actually happens. We can put something up there. It's the magic of technology. Sometimes you just think, New Year resolution. After that, we're speaking to folk from Muznet. Muzmatch, exactly. A dating service specifically for Muslims, which is fantastic. We've also got Alan Stevens and Fiona Moore joining us. So that's all to come in the next, let's say, hour and 20 or so minutes here on Southside Broadcasting. Time for the Black Eyed Peas.
Paint the town.
We'll shut it down.
Shut it down.
Let's burn the roof.
Woo! and then we'll do it again.
Let's do it, let's do it, let's do it, let's do it, and do it, and do it. Let's live it up and do it, and do it, and do it, do it, do it. Let's do it, let's do it, let's do it, do it, do it, do it. Here we come, here we go, we gotta rock. Easy come, easy go, now we on top. Feel the shot, body rock, rock it, don't stop. Round and round, up and down, around the clock.
And so the days and the time and the seconds and the years go by, and we say, let's make another New Year's resolution. Let's keep it this year. Let's get it sorted. Have you got any New Year's resolutions you've actually got on hand, Rachel?
Do you know what? I've decided this year to be on time, or more on time, for things. I am late for everything.
Punctuality,
I think it's very, very important in 2019.
Well, apparently a recent survey suggested that many British folk just can't keep those New Year's resolutions. And to address this, who better than our ace agony aunt extraordinaire? She is the awesome, I say that quite liberally and literally, awesome television psychologist extraordinaire. It's the fabulous Donna Dawson. How are you, Donna?
Wow, thank you so much for that wonderful introduction.
Donna, as we always say, it's what you deserve, and richly so. So happy New Year to your good self, Donna.
Happy New Year to you. It's good to be with you again.
Exactly, and you are officially our first interviewee telephonically of 2019.
Oh,
so great
wonderful.
News. Yeah, exactly.
That's brilliant. I like it.
Now, you heard Rachel there talking a bit about her sort of thought to be more punctual, etc. Is she going to keep it? What's the best way to keep those New Year's resolutions?
Well, interestingly enough, the best way to do it is to look at your goal and then see if you can break it down to smaller, more manageable steps and see how you can slide those into your present lifestyle, because you can't often make a big resolution without making a few changes to your lifestyle. This is what people forget, that you superimpose something on the way you live. It doesn't quite fit in. It seems harder and harder to do, and after a couple of weeks or maybe a month, you just give up. And in fact, in the survey that we did with Dr. Edgar Restaurante in partnership with Korn, they interviewed 2,000 people, and most people said that they got bored with their resolutions or felt they were unable to maintain them, to the point where 60% roughly said, I don't want to make them anymore. But on the other hand, 72% said it would be easier to stick to smaller resolutions. So, you know, instead of making a big sweeping resolution, I'm going to get fit, we all do that, what does that actually mean? Does it mean you want to lose weight? And if so, we need to look at diet. If it means more exercise, how are you going to do that and fit that around your work and your weekends, et cetera? So it is really about brainstorming all the ways you can help yourself. And I would say, write down every idea and activity that will help you to meet your goal. That could mean adding something to your lifestyle or subtracting something. There may be people that you may have to omit for a while or avoid doing certain things to help yourself. And also to find a way to reinforce your behavior, because sometimes going treat-free really makes you feel deprived. So if you're doing a vegan January, for instance, and you want to go meat-free, that doesn't mean you have to go treat-free. It means that you have to choose tasteless foods. Find ways to make it enjoyable so you'll stick to it.
I mean, certainly there's a lot of sage advice, as we knew would be the case with respect to that. I mean, Rachel, any thoughts from yourself?
I think that's brilliant. I think it is small, manageable chunks. And I've read a lot of books recently that are all about those kind of philosophies. And I think before it used to be about, you know, visualising the ends of your goals. But actually, I mean, if you're going to have a cake, you're not going to shove it all in one bite, are you? So the manageable chunks is very, very sensible. But I think sometimes we all just need a little reminder of how to do things. We kind of forget and we go, like you say, I want to get fit. People go, I want to get fit. And you're like, right. Go to the gym for 4 hours a day. No,
day.
Who does that? Who does that? It's not going to work, is it? It's not sustainable. So if you say, you know what, I'm going to start, and even if I just can make it to the door and do 20 minutes, then, yeah, it's about those small, manageable chunks. And I think, yeah, the reinforcement of behaviour is really important. It's like, if you do have those goals, taking a picture of yourself at the very beginning of your journey, and then 2 weeks later taking a picture. Because the minute you start to see those positive results, then you go, oh, this is exciting, and you want to do it more.
It needs to be a goal that you want to achieve, not because you feel you should, or somebody told you should, or social media said you should. It has to be one you really want to do. Otherwise, you will give it up sooner rather than later. And I think also you're right about going slowly. I mean, we aren't making resolutions on the back of the festive period when we've just overindulged. We've sat around watching TV. we feel terrible about ourselves, and we think, oh, new year, new start. It's almost like going cold turkey. I would almost use January as a kind of ease-in month. So you're cutting back or adding a little extra and not going mad, so that by February, some of those bad habits have already become better habits.
So really taking baby steps, Donna, is the key advice, really.
Yeah, because I think it's about understanding ourselves and how the difference between willpower and self-control. Often with willpower, it's like we feel it's all or nothing. And as soon as we've made a mistake, that's it, we've given up. Whereas with self-control, that's more about compromise. It, you know, allowing yourself to slip now and then. For instance, if you have a bad day, well, don't think about just the day. Think about the whole week. Think about the number of days in the week that's left to make up for that. So, you know, just expand your vision a little bit and forgive yourself. Dust yourself off, get up, and try again. For some people, it works to tell other people about what they're doing because then they say it out loud and they feel that they have to stick to it. Although sometimes your friends can sabotage you. If they know, for instance, you're trying to give up drink, they might slyly try to invite you out and for a drink, and just to see if you can fail.
It's so dry January.
Cut them out. Yes. Cut those people out. You don't need that negativity in your life.
You have to work out whether your friends are going to work for you or against you, and your family too.
In terms of, say, taking those baby steps, I mean, I'm always conscious of the always cliched phrase, really, that failure is not falling down, it's staying down. And that seems to be something you're referring to there, Donna, that it is important that if we do slip off the journey, etc. Exactly.
Yeah.
the transport
you didn't want to do it, did you?
I did. I was told about this. Avoid the cliche. But in terms of that, is it a case of ensuring that actually you can say, look, it's okay, give yourself permission to fail, actually.
Yes, absolutely. You know, we all have an inner masochist that beats us up all the time. It's the same masochist that tells us we need to make resolutions, we need to stick to them, we can't fail. If we fail, we're a complete
failure. I must mark all that student work. I must do it. I must do it now.
Yes, the oughts, the shoulds. We all have that negative voice. In fact, left to our own devices, we're our own worst critics. And I think what we have to learn is to be nice to ourselves. We've forgotten how to do that, how to be a little easy on ourselves and work with our psyche. Our psyche will tend to go for all or nothing, make a big sweeping statement about what we're going to achieve. And then, of course, the negative voice will go straight in there and go, well, you actually can't do that. It doesn't fit in with how you live, or it's too much of an impediment, or it's too much trouble, or this is boring. And then you have to talk your way around the voice. So a little bit of forethought. How am I going to work this into my life? Can I do this in small steps? I need to have the odd treat because otherwise I'll feel deprived. You have to understand your own nature.
Indeed. Know yourself, as the Oracle at Delphi.
Know yourself, yeah.
Donna, where can people go to find out further details about some of the things we've been talking about today, or indeed the Ristorante research itself?
Yes, the Pizza Ristorante, ending with an E, .co.uk will give you more ideas about healthy eating, and particularly if you want to go meat-free for January.
I've got to say, I was looking at Ristorante pizza, I thought, give up pizza? How could you possibly do it?
You can have a veggie pizza,
exactly.
Or a vegan one.
Definitely way forward. Donna, two final questions for you, good self. Thank you for remembering what they are. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting telephone link with us on the program today? Has it been good for you?
A wonderful link with you, and it was lovely to speak to both of you.
Oh, well, thank you. It was lovely to speak to you.
So can we look forward, as 2019 continues to maintain our New Year's resolution, will you be able to join us again later in the year?
I certainly hope so.
Hurrah!
Thank you.
If I could turn back time, if I could find a way, I'd take back those words that have hurt you, and you'd stay. I don't know why I did the things I did. I don't know why I said the things I said. Cries like a knife, it can cut deep inside. Words are like weapons, they wound sometimes. I didn't really mean to hurt you. I didn't want to see you go. I know I made you cry, but baby, if I could turn back time, if I could find a way, I'd take back those words that have hurt you. You'd stay if I could reach the stars.
Strokes affect 130,000 people in England and Wales each year. Here's a recipe that can dramatically decrease your chances of strokes.
Excellent. I better get a pen.
167 grams of calcium,
245 grams of magnesium, 3 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 grams of
could kill you.
Right, what was
and
the recipe?
That's the recipe.
Oh,
if
damn.
You would like a more simple solution, you can always call Farmer Nord on 01670 519989.
All right.
Or visit the website farmernord.co.uk.
Let me see if I can jot that down. What was the number again?
01670 519989. Or visit the website farmernord.co.uk.
And how do you spell Farmer Nord, I wonder?
PHARMANORD.co.uk.
It's almost as if I'm having a conversation with the radio.
Don't be silly, that's impossible.
Farmer Nord, winning the war of nutrition.
You're listening to a Southside Broadcasting podcast. Southside Broadcasting is a media company which aims to provide a wide range of features from the rural, health and lifestyle worlds. You can regularly listen to entertaining podcasts with interviews and correspondents from Los Angeles, Nashville, New York and London. You can take part in our Book of the Month features, grab some great nutritional advice, enjoy broadcasts from the Great Yorkshire Show, the Lincolnshire Show, and enjoy local football reviews with our regular feature, Fly Me to the Moon. You can even hear a BAFTA award-winning director drive a train full of teddy bears. You can listen to these and many more podcasts at southsidebroadcasting.podbean.com. For further information on how you can join over 35,000 people who regularly download our podcasts, call us on 01642 854 742 or email info@southsidebroadcasting.com now.
tight, yeah. I hear the music on me tight now, baby. I hear the music on me tight. I hear the music, I hear the music, baby.
Some might say after New Year, after birthday celebrations, after all sorts of things. What is that? Well, of course, this summer Saturday, sunny Saturday. It's coming up in a matter of hours from now, the 5th of January, sunshine Saturday to be precise, when more people book summer holidays than ever before. And the best person to actually talk about being aware of things you need to just kind of have air in mind when you're booking those summer holidays has to be consumer protection expert extraordinaire. It's the awesome Harry Wallop. How are you, Harry?
Morning. I'm very well, Alex.
Great, great to connect with your good self as ever. Now in the studio we've got wonderful actress Rachel Teete. Rachel, were you aware of Sunny Saturday?
I had no idea Sunshine Saturday even existed, but I'm excited to learn more about it.
5.2 million consumers will be booking their holidays in January.
Wow.
Not all on Saturday, presumably, but it is clearly that time, Harry, where we want to get away from the January blues and book in from that point of view.
Yes, I mean, there's been a long tradition of the holiday companies sort of launching their best deals, gosh, in the old days, of hard copy brochures, of publishing them in January.
Was that the 20th century, Harry?
Well, indeed. So this is the term sunshine Saturday may be new, but the concept is not. Okay. When the weather is miserable and cold outside is the time when people start thinking about booking their summer holidays.
Well, that makes perfect sense, Rachel.
It does.
What
really
sort of questions from yourself?
Give us some more advice about it. So what sort of things can a consumer do to protect themselves if, for example, I booked something now and then maybe life changed before summer?
Well, indeed. So there's a survey or a study put out by ATOL, which is the Consumer Protection Organization or scheme run by Civil Aviation Authority, pointing out that actually more than two-thirds, nearly 70% of people, don't bother looking at the small print when it comes to booking a holiday to see whether they will be protected. If, heaven forbid, and I'm afraid to say it does happen, your holiday collapses before you have a chance to get on that plane, be it the holiday company going into administration or anything like that, or even worse, you're on your sun lounger on the other side of the world enjoying life, and then you suddenly get an alert to discover that the company who flew you out there has now run out of whatever it might be, planes, money, staff, and can't get you back.
It is a bit frustrating when you have the official line, see, you wouldn't want to be you, and they basically sort of say they've left you there. So you think, I didn't want to be in I'm a Celebrity. I don't have a holiday and get back home as well.
I once got stuck in Madeira for an extra 24 hours, and that was really quite frightening.
Really? Why were you stuck in Madeira?
The pilot was out of his hours, so couldn't fly back in the end, and we kept being delayed and delayed. But I know now that panic of going, oh, I've got to be back, I've got work to go to, I had some filming to go to, and you can't just, it's not like you can go, oh yeah, I'll just get on a train and come back. It's not that easy sometimes, so it does happen.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So it all depends on what sort of holiday you're on. So if you're on a package holiday, which sort of 4 in 10 of us still take, a package holiday, then you need to check that your holiday company is part of the ATOL scheme, which nearly all of them are, and they have a guarantee that they will get you home. You can finish your holiday and you will get home, even if it's on a different airline. And then if you book independently, then you need to make sure that, well, you need to make sure all sorts of things. Mostly your travel insurance is up to scratch. And you are covered, of course, by various things like delays. So if you are stuck in Madeira through no fault of your own, then under EU regulations, you are entitled to compensation and indeed to get your flight back home as soon as possible.
Now, you've mentioned, obviously, those two letters EU. After March the 29th, a major thing might be happening. Is that something travellers should be aware of? Is that, because, I mean, we've heard, it could be Armageddon, it could be apocalypse, it could not be, it might be a case of pilots not necessarily being out of hours, but out of their skulls. Who knows what could be happening on that sort of basis? Harry, any thoughts with respect to that? Or is it a case of, no, I'm still giving advice to Theresa May at this moment?
Well, no, I mean, this is a fascinating question, and of course, we just don't know. On the one hand, both the British side and the EU side say planes will continue to fly completely as normal and we won't notice any difference. And yet senior members of the travel industry only a month or so ago, head of Thomas Cook, was saying, well, in the very worst case scenario, there really could be quite a bit of disruption, probably only around March the 29th itself or the week of that, if there's a terrible sort of chaotic no deal. Who knows? And we know from the whole Gatwick thing just before Christmas with the drone, you only need a small amount of disruption, and then there's this sort of huge knock-on effect. I think long-term, I think we won't notice, hopefully, touch wood, we won't notice any difference whatsoever. And indeed, if you book a holiday through a holiday company that's a member of ABTA, the Association of British Travel Agents, they have made a pledge that Brexit will have no effect. And if there is a sort of chaotic no-deal Brexit, then you will still go on your holiday exactly as planned.
Hurrah.
Exactly.
Just avoid that week in March then, really. Last week in March, first week of April. Avoid that.
It's not a very popular time to go travelling, but I'd be I mean, it will be absolutely fascinating to know whether that has any effect on bookings. I mean, I did have a friend who was thinking of saving money by booking a plane to Gibraltar on March the 29th itself. It just seemed the one location in Europe I might be a little bit nervous about booking and knowing whether it's going to happen or not.
Harry, we could put them in touch with our Gibraltarian correspondent, Gabriella Peralta.
But Gibraltar is amazing. My best friend lives there. It's gorgeous.
You've got your monkeys, Taylor's monkeys.
You have.
Apes.
Inside the rock.
It's just amazing. Harry, where are you likely to be heading off to in 2019? Anything planned for yourself?
Yes, I've already booked my summer holiday. Excitingly, I'm off to Greece, which I haven't been to for years and years, and going off with my children, who have never been to Greece before.
Oh,
it's becoming a popular location, apparently.
Indeed so. We won't talk about financial challenges with respect to the Greek government, because that's another line entirely. But
I was just thinking Mamma Mia. I was thinking you could recreate Mamma Mia with them, and that would be beautiful, and that's my idea
of it. That could be a challenge, Harry, to actually look to recreate at least one sequence from Mamma Mia when you're actually over there with the Wallop household.
My daughter would be very excited at that prospect. My sons would not be, however.
All the more reason to do it.
Clearly. Best place to go to online to find out further details about this wonderful campaign from Atoll, Harry?
There's a website called www.packpeaceofmind, peace as in war and peace, packpeaceofmind.co.uk.
Harry, it's been fantastic, as we knew it would be. Has it been an okay telephonic link for you?
Yes, absolutely.
So can we speak again, probably, as say, post the Brexit event that may or may not actually happen in March?
I look forward to it.
Hurrah!
When I wake up in the morning, love, and the sunlight hurts my eyes, and something without warning, love, bears heavy on my mind. Then I look at you, and the world's alright with me. Just one look at you, and I know it's gonna be a lovely day. Instead of me, always seems to know the way. Then I look at you, and the world's all right with me. Just one look at you, and I know it's gonna be a lovely day. Instead of me,
know the way. Then I look at you, and the world's alright with me. Just one look at you, and I know it's gonna be
how Bill manages to keep his breath control there. It's all from the diaphragm, apparently. Breathe from the diaphragm and good things will happen. Bill Withers, lovely day. Reminds me of an appalling little line which I was once informed of, and it goes something like, how can you make a duck into a soul singer, Rachel? How can you make a duck into a soul singer?
I have no idea.
Put it in a microwave until it's Bill Withers.
Yeah, I'm not going to be reusing that one.
No. I thought maybe after 18
years. Was that a cracker joke?
No. However, upcoming, it's the FA Cup. Well, it starts this evening with, of course, Tranmere taking on board Tottenham. Borough are at home to Rotherham.
And, Peterborough.
Peterborough, you're quite right.
It's the Battle of the Boroughs.
Absolutely, thank you. Yes, it's Man City here at home to Rotherham. So we'll be talking about giant killers. And whether Peterborough will be classified as a giant killer if they beat Middlesbrough, it's not going to happen. We'll be asking for your predictions and more, a kind of adjunct to Fly Me to the Moon, which of course is still downloadable from our last epic scenario where Rachel had 100% record with one of the scores. That was, of course, the...
It was a complete fluke.
Exactly. It was, I think you said, 2-0 for Borough against, not Sheffield Wednesday, but Ipswich Town.
Uh-huh. Yes, it did.
Spot on. Yeah. You said Middlesbrough 2, Ipswich Town 0. You're absolutely right with respect to that. You also said Middlesbrough were going to beat Sheffield Wednesday 3-2. Mm. In fact, Sheffield Wednesday beat Borough 1-0.
Yes. Never mind.
Okay. And Derby, of course, drew 1-1.
Yes.
New Year's Day. So I'm sure Rob will be quite happy with respect to that. Next Fly Me to the Moon coming up in a matter of weeks, of course, with respect to Southside Broadcasting and more. So coming up next, Giant Killers and more with Chris Hollins and hopefully Mark Hill. And indeed, many folk would say it'd be a very, very, very good thing if Blackpool can actually beat Arsenal. Or indeed, if Tranmere can beat Tottenham. But not so much if Peterborough would get a result against Middlesbrough, because that wouldn't be a good thing at all, really, from a Middlesbrough point of view. But Lincoln City have proven that it can be a good thing when it's the FA Cup, the magic of the FA Cup. It's become a cliche, but we still like to refer to it. And what better way to talk about Britain's love of the underdog and our love affair with the FA Cup than with two fantastic individuals. First of all, sports correspondent extraordinaire Chris Hollins. How are you, Chris?
I'm extremely well, thank you.
Fantastic. It's fair to say, Chris, that Rachel Teat, our wonderful actress co-host this morning, was very impressed with a whole range of things that you've put together over life, really, it's fair to say. Isn't that right, Rachel?
His life goals, yeah, mainly Strictly, but yeah.
Do you know what? I was suddenly wondering where you were going with that.
Yeah.
There could have been many avenues, but, yes, you know, it was the Strictly thing.
Do I know her? Yes. No, Strictly Come Dancing. I know it'll stay with me forever, that, won't it?
Yeah, it will.
Somewhat worst ever champion.
Well, speaking of underdog, I mean,
exactly.
It was a beautiful Cinderella story, wasn't it?
It was a Cinderella story, and what a great link you are. unfancied teams, unfancied dancers going all the way. It's very British, isn't it? I wonder what I'm trying to think about why we love the underdog. But is it our little island mentality that, you know, anything is possible, we can beat anybody, we can be the best, but we don't want anyone to boast about it. And we don't want anybody, we always want to bring the big boys back down to earth. We don't want them to get too big for their boots. And I think that's what we love about the FA Cup, that one day, out of the year, all these wonderful football clubs that are the best in the world will have to play away from home or at home against a low team, and anything's possible.
Well, I was particularly intrigued that the manager of Solihull, of course, who were beaten by Blackpool, I should say, was just so enthused by being even in the draw and mentioned in the same breath as Arsenal that they thought, oh, wow, clearly you say we see whether Blackpool can actually beat Arsenal. I can't see it happening myself, personally. But.
Well, you never know. I mean, there's a survey, LG Electronics have done this survey, and I think it's really rewarding because, look, I'm old school. My father played in the FA Cup and won the FA Cup. He's lost the FA Cup final. So it's in my blood. And I must admit, at one stage I thought, you know, has the romance, the magic of the cup gone? But this survey says no. 30% of us still love the idea that a big team will lose to a little team. And look, there's going to be Lincoln City travelling to Everton. No one gives Lincoln City a chance. But Everton, low in confidence, manager under pressure, Lincoln City flying high, you just never know.
Well, the Cowley brothers obviously have a bit of a track record because their dream voyage to the sixth round of the FA Cup was 2 years ago.
2017, wasn't it?
And served as a platform for the Cowley brothers to really take off from their management career. And obviously Lincoln now almost actually heading up through the leagues. And I wouldn't say guaranteed promotion, but they're looking very healthy.
Never say guaranteed promotion. I think, look, and that's also a very important thing. All those players playing for Lincoln City, all of them will say, I should have been playing for a Premier League team. They've got a point to prove, and they're going to be on television.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's crazy. Here I am, just over 20, 25, well, I'm 47. And someone says FA Cup to me, and I'll say, Ronnie Radford scoring for Hereford United against Newcastle United. I wasn't even born, but I watched it on television, on that muddy pitch, scoring a great goal. It's not Bobby Charlton, Dennis Law, Pele. It's Ronnie Radford playing for Hereford United. Mm. But that day, he was the biggest name in the UK.
And
he caused a big cup shock.
And Watson's commentary, of course.
And John Watson in his first ever match. Mm. Now, one player is going to be that hero this weekend. Guaranteed.
See, that excites me. I think that's so wonderful to think that anything can happen this weekend in the world of football. And that must be so nice, especially for a player who maybe doesn't get that turnout and the name chanted every single week like they would in some of the big clubs.
Do you like they used to chant out Mark Hill's name on a regular basis?
Perhaps, yeah. But I did go through and go, ooh, who out of all these teams do I want to win? And I picked the underdog every single time.
So Tranmere against Tottenham.
Yeah.
And talk to them. See, and that's it, you see. Look, you know, my son is, what, 4.5, and we may sit down and watch our first FA Cup match, you know, this weekend, and he's going to, he'll probably be bored and run off and go and play in the train. But what will happen is a story may have, and LG Electronics are sort of partners with the FA Cup, and they've been taking it on a tour around the UK, and to see the faces of these young kids when they see that iconic trophy and they can touch it and they can lift it is incredible. And it's maybe, I think, more accessible than maybe the Premier League and the Champions League, because it's their cup. So as you mentioned, Blackpool, lowly, poor old Blackpool, are going to play against Arsenal.
Yeah.
And suddenly they're on the map. Suddenly that town is big, and it's all about football that weekend, just for that weekend. And if they win, it's another weekend.
And, of course, the tour of the cup, it actually was present in the University of Lincoln just a year or so ago, and the excitement amongst students was just palpable, it's tangible, where they could actually just be photographed by the trophy. It's just wonderful. It brings it home to all sorts of folk. We mentioned Mark Hill. Mark, are you actually there?
Yes, Mark,
I'm here. Yeah.
Good, that's
dragging him in here. He's
just having a coffee break.
Here's a man that's lived that dream. You've lived it, haven't you, Mark?
Yeah, I've played in the FA Cup and been involved in the third round, maybe... Yeah, four or five times for different clubs.
So, I'm pleased we identified that, because when we were doing some initial research, we weren't sure whether we were the Scottish Celtic
player.
Exactly. I had some success playing at Maidstone United.
Maidstone, yeah.
Yeah, and we had some good results there. I was talking to Chris earlier. You know, we were playing away at Newport a few years ago, many years ago now, and, you know, 1-0 down, 88th minute. I scored an equaliser. We then scored a winner. And that club, we end up going to Watford, who in the, you know, the Premier League, First Division, you know, huge crowd for us, huge money for the club.
Big players,
John Barnes was playing, and, you know, we scored after 20 minutes at Vicarage Road, and, oh, God, what have we done there? You know, you start going, wow, you know, but it's a great experience, and, you know, fans and, you know, players, it's just, all, you know, the memory's all about cups, and like Chris said earlier, so many kids will see the cup this weekend and watch their first games. I think it's more accessible. You know, Premier League tickets are hard to get hold of. You know, you can be a kid in Blackpool tonight is going to go and see a Premier League team play, you know, in the FA Cup. I mean, he's dreaming that his club are going to get a result tonight, and I think that's the excitement of it.
I love that. I think that's so important, because, yeah, maybe you don't have the money to be able to go to every single match, but just that one that's a little bit different, a little bit special, why not make it Blackpool versus Arsenal?
Yeah, actually, many people, it will be their first game, you know. And just, I was talking to one of our guys at LG at work the other day. He took his son to Wembley on Monday and did the Wembley tour. And his son got to pick up the FA Cup in, you know, where you lift the trophy. And his kids, he said, oh, my God, he said, I can't thank you enough for arranging that. He said, it was amazing. He said, they're lovely presents for Christmas. All they're talking about is going to Wembley and lifting the FA Cup up. You know, so that's great for those kids.
It was something Middlesbrough fans were looking forward to a few years ago.
Oh, don't!
Well,
don't hit me where it hurts!
But what I love about it, and it was great, we were talking to someone a little bit earlier, and he said, the greatest match I ever went to was an FA Cup match. And we said, oh, what, a final? Was it this? And he said, no, it was like third round. Sheffield United against Coventry, cold. It was 1-1, pouring with rain, and we won on penalties. And you think, why would that be memorable? And he said, because it was the crowd were on fire. Everything was all about just getting to the next round. It was our one-off chance of putting one over on Coventry. They were a big team, we were a little team. And you suddenly think, yeah, I get it. You know, if you're a supporter of a team in a league, you pretty much know where you're going to be. But by the end of the season, you're in the playoffs, you're in a relegation battle, or you're trying to get promotion. Whereas this weekend, it's a one-off. You can have a dream for a week.
All to play for, isn't it?
Woking people can believe they too could beat Watford. Amazing.
We fancy this one, don't we, Mark?
We do. Actually, one of my old playing colleagues is manager there at Woking, Alan Dowson. He's a Geordie, and I still can't understand him. He needs subtitles. But, if they win and the BBC, they need to put subtitles up on Match of the Day on for the weekend. But they will be up for it. You know, who knows what team Watford are going to put out. You know, it's that big dream. And, you know, Woking have been playing in front of, 1,500 people. Mm. They have a full house on Saturday, which is fantastic. And TV money, you know, that guarantees them, you know, hopefully it will take them back up into the conference next year. You know, and it's just something different. Some teams now are mid-table already. You know, you've got the Premier League, there's a few teams there mid-table.
Have to go
and win a trophy for your club.
Although we do have to spare a thought for the trauma that can be caused, and I'm speaking as a Man City fan who still has difficulty coping with the Shrewsbury defeat of the 1980s that we actually had, and, you know, it's one of those areas where hopefully Rotherham will not prove to be too traumatic a time on Sunday when we also, you know,
but that's
get
also
into
part
that
of the Magic Cup, those traumas. We've all been there.
Yeah.
Okay, prediction time, gentlemen. We're not only asked for the full scores, but what about a battle of the boroughs? We have to put this to you in terms of Middlesbrough versus Peterborough. Mark, what would your suggestion be for that?
Although I know Barry Fire very well at Peterborough, I think that'll be a clear win for Middlesbrough.
For Tony Pulis?
Yep.
My word. Chris, would you agree?
Yes, go on. You've got to go for Middlesbrough, I think.
Yay!
And
thanks, guys.
Yeah, my pleasure.
What about Lincoln City? Do you think they have a chance against Everton?
I would love to see it 0-0, 75 minutes at Goodison Park, because that crowd can turn a bit, can't it, at Everton. Everton, really low on confidence. I would love it. That sounds like Kevin Keegan. With Lincoln City could nick that one.
Yeah, the two pubs there have done a great job, and they've got a good recent few years in the Cup, some good performances there. And I think Everton, they need some good performances, and I'm not sure they're playing great at the moment. They've spent a lot of money, and I think that could be a little upset on that one.
Well, I'm still actually celebrating after last night's result against Liverpool, actually, for as a City fan. So, exactly. We're back in it, thankfully. Where can people go to, Chris, to find out further details about this survey and more?
Well, if you would like to know about the survey and how you can watch all of the FA Cup matches, go to www.lg.com/UK.
Absolutely, and obviously connecting strictly with the FA Cup, I think we've managed to do that very neatly. Well done, Rachel.
Well done. I have to say, the FA Cup is slightly better today than a glitter ball.
Well, there might be more viewers for one of them.
Come answering on it because the D's dropped off.
Exactly, we shall work through that. Chris Hollins and Mark Hill, many thanks, gentlemen. Hopefully we'll speak again very soon.
Yes, look forward to it.
Take care, bye.
was all around me, and saw the feeling grow. It's written on the wind, it's everywhere I go. Oh, yes it is. So if you really love me, come on and let it show.
Oh, three W's of Wet, 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 and the theme that was used so fruitfully in the movie Love Actually. And Love Lives Online for Everyone. New research commissioned by Muzmatch, an app designed specifically for Muslims trying to find a partner, has looked into viewpoints on relationship expectations and finding love in both Muslim and non-Muslim communities. And to talk about this, findings and more, and how advanced technology can impact us in all sorts of ways for 2019, who better than the founder and chief executive officer of Muzmatch, the fabulous Shahzad Younas. How are you, Shahzad?
Morning, very well, thank you.
And the equally wonderful CTO of Muzmatch, and also founder, Ryan Brettle. How are you, Ryan?
Very well, very well. Good to talk to you.
Excellent. Shahzad, talk to us about Muzmatch, please.
Yeah, no, exactly. So, I mean, what is Muzmatch? Muzmatch is essentially an app for Muslims looking for a life partner, simply put. So, some people kind of say, oh, it's like a Muslim Tinder. As an easy comparison.
No, surely not. No,
we're a lot more than that. You know, I think
swipe right, swipe left, swipe swipe up, swipe down.
You know, we've got every angle of swiping going on. For us, it's literally people who are looking for something serious. You know, they're looking for a life partner. And you know, for us with Muzmatch, what we've done is, you know, really blended modern technology, modern apps, and kind of the modern expectations of people when they use apps and online services. With something that really respects their religious values and maybe their cultural values as well, and just the sensitivities in terms of finding a partner within the Muslim faith.
There is, of course, that very important line that culturally there are so many challenges, and when we talk about, obviously, people from different faiths, different ideologies, different systems, belief systems, otherwise, obviously these are very important terms. So if they're looking for a life partner, then presumably they don't necessarily want the challenge of suddenly having to completely rewrite their own hardwiring when it comes to the beliefs and so on.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, it's you know what it comes down to? Just straight compatibility. You know, people will have maybe their way of life, their way of thinking, etc. You know, when you meet someone, you know, take religion out of it. When you meet someone, generally, you know, you're looking for someone who kind of agrees with the same kind of stuff that you do. I'm talking generally. And I think just religion is just one part of that. It's one vein that people think along. You know, they might have certain life beliefs, especially when you're thinking about children and that kind of stuff. You know, people will have an idea of how they want their children to be raised and all of that kind of stuff. So bringing religion into it is, you know, for many people, it's a big factor. You know, whether it's Muslim, Christian, Jewish, you know, there's so many different types of dating apps for different segments of society and people who have different beliefs. You know, we're just one of them as well.
Ryan, when you came up with this particular app, was it a case you thought, this is it, this is the killer application, this is, take a hike, Tinder, and other such things, etc., or did you sort of think, well, actually, this is, you know, there's a real important reason for this as well?
Yeah, I guess being a non-Muslim, it was different for me. I thought at first, you know, Shaz reached out to me with the product, and at first I thought someone must be doing this for this market, 2 billion Muslims, and no one was. And we just thought this is such an amazing opportunity, and like you said, we can actually do a lot of good here. So we've had 20,000 weddings now from the app.
Wow!
Yeah.
Have you had any invites yourself to the weddings?
Yeah, many.
Have
many.
You?
Did some weddings.
Awesome.
We get photos. It's amazing. We get people sending in photos, you know, now pictures of kids now, which is great.
I love
you know,
this.
For us, it's people around the world, you know, meeting on the app. It's amazing.
That's so exciting. And yet, I can't believe that the market wasn't already, that you know, there wasn't something there for that. And the fact that you can think slightly more seriously, I think sometimes when you think about these dating apps, people aren't really there to find life partners, or some people aren't there for that. And if there's a place you can go to get that, then that's quite exciting, I think.
It makes so much sense, and our users are so serious about finding the partner. They use the product in such a kind of a different way than someone might use, say, a Tinder. And that's great. You know, we've built a platform for them, and this is it. 1 million people are finding their partner.
Where can I sign up?
Muzmatch.com. It's free.
Download the app.
It's free as well. Wow.
Absolutely.
It's clearly an unbelievable sort of winner from that point of view. As it progresses into 2019, we can presumably see this going from strength to strength.
Exactly. I mean, we're literally, so we've just hit 1 million members now, so it's a huge milestone for us, you know, in less than 4 years. It's amazing growth, and for us, you know, we've grown to this stage purely because it's worked for so many people. You know, people telling their friends, saying, you know what, I was on Muzzmatch and I actually found my partner. It actually works. Because, you know, some people always have an apprehension about online, etc. Whereas for us, we have so many success stories and people we can point to that can, you know, kind of say it loud, say it proud. You know what, I met on Muzzmatch and we got married. So we've so far got a fantastic record, and it's really just cementing that. So kind of one big thing that we did was, you know, we kind of translated the app into about 14 different languages, which is a big project on our side. And, you know, that for us, that's really looking at global growth and you know, spreading the story of Muzzmatch and, you know, the way we do things.
Certainly times have changed since, I think, about 2 decades ago, where the very notion of actually going online kind of marked you out as a complete failure from that point of view.
Well, it scares me. It completely scares me, the idea of not knowing who you might be talking to, or, you know.
It's so much better, though, right? Because, you know, this is a big decision, you know, who you choose to marry. And, of course, the more people you meet, you know, the more likely that you're going to find the right person for you. And on the note about, you know, kind of who are you talking to, we actually verify every profile. So before you can use Muzzmatch, someone by hand approves your profile against your selfie that you take, and loads of other different factors. So you know when you're talking to someone on Muzzmatch, it is actually them, which is super important.
I love that. I think that's amazing. And as well, that should be a huge selling point of it. I'm sure it is.
Yeah, for us, and this really does go back down to us not being a casual hookup dating type of app. For us, it's an app with people with serious intent. And that kind of guides the product, how we've built it, how we've designed it, all the little things that we've thought about. You know, when we talked in terms of people actually finding their partner, you know, one of the, call it, questions on the profile that we ask people is, you know what, when are you actually looking to get married? You know, for some people, they're looking straight away. You know, if I meet someone, I'm ready to get married now. Or we have people at university who are like, you know what, maybe 2 years' time I'm looking to get married, but I'm happy to kind of meet someone now. And it, for us, it really helps align people together in terms of what they're looking for, and just helps them make that decision in terms of, if I'm talking to someone, okay, are we thinking on the same wavelength here? And I think that's why people have found so much success on our app.
Clearly, it's not a mismatch, it's Muzzmatch.
There you go.
Hey! You just created the next branding strategy.
It's another one, Muzzmatch.com, the place to go to. Gentlemen, it's been awesome connecting with your good self today. Shehzad and Ryan, keep on keeping on, and I'm sure we'll speak again very soon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
So far, are you quite sure just who you are? Oh, I know you could choose a friend, but you don't seem to have the time. Oh, and I wonder if you ever get to say what's on your mind. We'll take a little time. Come on, take a little time.
Yeah.
the radio phone-in's dream, of course. The feeling, and I love it when you call. I love it when I can get hold of a copy of Interzone magazine, and we have such awesome words as these written down for you. Isn't that right, Rachel?
I looked the other way and saw the Ant Lady. She wasn't screaming, she was smiling. That little knowing smile from before. She had an anti-ant flamethrower in her hands and was gazing, not at the surging insects, but at the burning house, the shifting noise of falling beams, the terrified Ukrainians on the lawn. Nobody, of course, was paying any attention to her. Them, she crooned. Them.
Jeez, the anti-ant... The anti-ant...
Anti-ant flamethrower!
Who could have possibly created the anti-ant flamethrower other than the awesome Professor Fiona Moore? How are you, Fiona?
I'm pretty good. I'm glad you read it.
Of course.
For those listeners of you who might not know, that's in the latest issue of Interzone magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a short story I wrote. It's sort of speculative exercise. You know, everybody, I'm sure, is pretty familiar with, on your listenership anyway, is pretty familiar with the 1954 movie Them, in mm-hmm. which mm-hmm. communism is metaphorically represented by giant ants.
Of course.
So this effectively takes place in the same universe, but now. Hmm. The giant ants they don't exactly represent communism, but something else that was on people's minds in the 50s, and something that's really very much present.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the old lady with the anti-ant flamethrower is in fact the little girl who in the film, you know, in the clip everybody's seen is just screaming them, them, mm-hmm. them.
Mm-hmm. No, she's crooning.
She's crooning them.
It was fantastic. I mean, yeah, again, the movie rights have to be signed up now. We need mm-hmm. to work through that process. Already, Rachel Teat has a quality actress.
get me in there.
Sorted to, it'll get me onto Driving Ambition as well from that point of view. Anyway.
I hope you enjoy that.
It's a whole new side to your character that I'm just seeing, Fiona, opening up like a wonderful, like peeling layers of a perfectly formed onion, really. It's fantastic. If only Chris Chibnall was aware of this kind of quality of writing. Win-win situation for every Doctor Who scenario that's actually there. Anyway, Happy New Year, Fiona Moore.
Happy New Year to you too.
And Happy New Year, Alan Stevens.
Happy New Year, Alex.
Excellent, there we are. We felt we had to give Fiona a right of going straight into that because, again, given that Rachel's already been doing some research into the numbers as far as the Doctor Who, it's the lowest rated one
ever. It's the lowest rating one, yeah. 5.15 million for New Year's Day. Mm. Which doesn't sound that low to me, but... You know, especially compared to Call the Midwife, that was 3.2. But, yeah.
What was the highest?
Well, Luther got slightly more, but the previous year, you see, Sherlock ended up getting 8 to 9 million.
Sherlock wasn't on last year.
Oh. Well, then the website I read was wrong.
Maybe it's on, I don't know. But
was it on New Year's Day at some point?
I don't think it was on last year, was it, Fiona?
Yeah, I think it might have been on the year before last. I mean, wasn't there that... when? The last one I can remember was that sort of deeply incomprehensible one about some kind of feminist KKK.
Hmm. That sounds like a Stephen Moffat script, you know, deeply incomprehensible.
Sounds like a Happy New Year for everyone.
Good. However, you know, and I have to say, I haven't quite managed to work my way through the entirety of Resolutions yet. It's my New Year's resolution to actually watch Resolution.
You should have spoken to Donna about how you could do it. Small, manageable chunks.
That's exactly what our ace TV psychologist would have probably launched the show with had I uttered that whole thing.
And reinforce yourself with a treat.
Mm-hmm. We purchase a Fiona Moore book.
Absolutely.
Exactly. Or indeed anything from Magic Bullet Productions, clearly. There are lots of other great things that are actually there, by your command being just one of them.
A new book as well.
Yeah, that's, for the benefit of listeners, that's edited by Rich Handley, and Lou Tembone. It's out from Sequart Press. It's a volume celebrating the 40th anniversary of the original series of Battlestar Galactica and the 15th of the new, because they conveniently came out on anniversary years. And, it's just basically covering everything to do with Battlestar Galactica, and we do have a...
Both series.
Yeah, both series, and Alan and I have a modest contribution looking at the webisodes, which was really quite interesting to research, because... One of the things that webisodes, they're kind of not old enough yet for there to be much in the way of history about them, but also at the same time they're not new enough for there to be much information about them. So it was kind of fascinating tracing the development of webisodes, and it turns out that Battlestar Galactica actually came out at a very pivotal time in the history of online content. And may have arguably contributed to the success of such online platforms as YouTube and Dailymotion.
Well, YouTube have even started making their own TV programs these days, which you can actually purchase as well on the YouTube television platform. Extraordinary. And no little kittens playing cats either. It's amazing. However, that's all part of a rich tapestry. It's 15 years since the remake of Battlestar Galactica. The remake which was billed as the first official television series which reflected accurately the trauma of America post 9/11. Very good. And, of course, it's got lots of ace books and things produced about it. But let's move back to The Good Doctor and Jodie Whittaker and the fact that they were in Siberia, Yorkshire, all parts of the globe in many ways, trying to seek out this strange of fireworks displays over the centuries developed for the fans, etc. What did you make of it? And let's go to Fiona first for this.
Mixed bag, from my point of view. It was fun. I liked the look of the new Dalek. I liked the kind of action-y chase bits and so forth, I thought it really suffered on the pacing front. To be honest, I thought they could have lost Ryan's dad from the story entirely, and it would probably have been better for it. It didn't need to have been him, even if they were absolutely stuck on having the MacGuffin resolution that they did. It didn't need to be his dad bringing it into the story. And the pacing was kind of odd. Stories need slower beats, but some of them came in with this one to the point where they dragged it down to a crashing halt. The action just sort of suddenly came to a crashing halt, and it was like, whoa, whiplash here.
Interesting
too
comments.
Too much info dumps, and also really, that whole, it's divided into three parts and put around the globe. It's like, well, you could have saved yourself about 5 minutes and a bunch of effects footage and just had it in Sheffield, frankly, for all the other parts contributed to the plot.
Yeah, although that wouldn't have allowed for the external travel, I presume, to actually go to some of the other exotic places, really, if they just based it in Sheffield. However, maybe they didn't travel at all. Alan, you gave some very interesting reviews for the series. So you literally went from both extremes. It's like a binary opposition. It was total both extremes. Best ever to worst ever. Hopeless. Wouldn't feed it to my cats in any way, shape, or form.
I wouldn't give my cats good stuff. I never give my stuff crap.
Exactly. So what were your views about Resolution?
It's called Resolution, wasn't it? Yeah, I call it Dustbin of the Daleks. It looks sort of like it's kind of dustbin, doesn't it? I remember years ago, there was a Doctor Who story called Dalek and the Bannermen, and it takes place in part on at Barry Island. And there's a shot of this camp, and then suddenly this bus just drops at the sky and goes wham! Straight down in front of the camera, which I mean is great. Obviously, they just had it on a crane and dropped it, And that was a bit like when the Dalek landed, I always thought, is all bang! So I thought it was quite funny. Production-wise, it was it was nicely filmed and reasonably well directed. And I like the sort of new design of the, or perhaps an old design of Newton. I don't know where it is. Ninth century Dalek came from.
Apparently, it's entirely remote controlled.
Was it really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Right. Interesting, eh?
Well,
that's going to create problems for those actors who used to.
Yeah, never work with children, animals, or remote-controlled Daleks.
Clearly.
So, when we say what was the mutant or the machine?
The machine.
Oh, right.
The mutant was a real equity signed up actor, presumably.
Yeah, the mutant was an equity mutant.
Exactly. It could have been a remote-control mutant, couldn't it? But anyway, what was I going to make? Yeah, what I think of it. Well, unfortunately, it was written by Chris Chibnall.
Oh.
And the problem with Chris Chibnall is that he has. He needs script editing, and
but he's the showrunner. He scripts himself.
You should really have a showrunner as possibly the best writer on the show. Chris Boucher was probably the best writer, one of the best writers on Blake 7. Robert Holmes is certainly the best writer.
Russell T. Davis.
Yes, Russell T. Davis.
Well, Russell T. Davis also was very good, but the problem with
Chris Chibnall.
Chris Chibnall.
Say the words.
Isn't any good at all. He's terrible. He can't edit anything. He can't write dialogue. He has no idea of how to, you know.
How does he have a career? Has he got the negatives?
To be honest, even very good writers need editors. I mean, Davies can certainly deliver the goods. Davies can write very well, but the problem is that I really think that, with all respect to him, his writing for Doctor Who would have been much improved if there had been somebody there who could just basically say something like, you know, Russell, don't end it this way, come up with something better than having Tennant gabble out an explanation at 50 miles an hour while everything blows up, okay?
Well, the thing about, well, I've been quite a criticism of Russell when he was doing it, but in defense of him, I'd say that he was a guy who... there was a huge amount of work he did, and a lot of them, you know, not just rewriting other people's scripts, but writing his own script as well. And also, I think there was an anxiety about starting it, and he would often start stuff late, and it would end up, you know, basically it would be first drafts going to screen. And as first drafts, you know, they were very, very good. If they had been, you know, second or third drafts, or had a script editor of a very high caliber, then those scripts would have been polished.
But that's what
the thing is with I don't know whether this is the same. I mean, I've heard these. That Chibnall is struggling, whether that's true or not, I don't know, that he's finding Doctor Who extremely wearing and difficult to do. But the fact is, whether he's a first-round script or, you know, I've always seen, you know, no matter what script he's written, they always have the same flaws. I mean, there's pacing flaws.
Dinosaurs on a spaceship.
They don't entirely marry up. It's like he takes a lot of elements and throws them together, and some of them gel and some of them don't, and that's what you have. So you have this idea that a Dalek arrived in the 9th century and had a battle with these people and was split into three sections, and then 1100 years later some ultraviolet light shows on one bit and they all mash together again. It turns, I mean, why? What is that saying? Why bother going to Siberia? Why bother having his 9th century thing? Why was the Dalek in 9th century? There's a picture of it. It looks like a sort of, you know, time war Dalek. Did it travel in time? What was it doing there? So all these elements was irrelevant. And then you had a case of where Ryan meets his dad. I mean, Ryan's a good actor, and his dad was a good actor as well, but it goes into that sort of cliche of black guy who abandons his parents, you know, which basically also surfaced in Sarah Jane Avengers. Remember the that kid in that, and his father also with an absent father, and he came back, and then he started acting in a kind of violent way. So you've got, again, this, you know, the idea of, it's basically the same story.
Like a muzzmatch, really.
Father comes back, he's taken over by alien, you know, and then there's some kind of redemptive element in the end, though I don't quite know what it was, and the thing is pulled off his back. In the positive stuff, I'd say that I like the mutant. I think actually Nick Briggs was very, very good as the mutant. I like the voice he gave it. I like the incidental music. I liked it when he was driving 103 miles. She was driving 103 miles an hour along the motorway, you know. And a policeman came in and said, "You know, excuse me, do you realize you've been doing 103, madam?" And she says, "You're an enemy of the Daleks." He says, "Well, can you spell that?" You know, I think that kind of worked. And I think there was also an element about the Dalek, which was, you know, like an arrow, you know, I am going there, you know, and no matter what is in the way, it will. So she turns up the archive, and the chap comes and goes, "Hello, I was burnt," bang, dead, hand against hand scanner, you know, into the thing.
I got chills there with that impersonation.
That was just the remote control. The Dalek couldn't do anything else.
Sorry, what?
We were just commenting on the sort of acting that you were bringing to the bear there. It's very good.
So what I'm saying is that there was a kind of, you know...
Curate's egg, lacking, I think, is the message I'm getting. Curate's egg. A curate's egg of a production.
What was lacking? What the last episode of the season, the Battle of, well, whatever a damn thing was called.
Rakskor Akkas.
Yeah, that, a lot of people were saying, well, that wasn't really very happy in what was a very conclusive ending. There was a number of threads in the story of it. The Doctor, you know, going into a story where everything wasn't entirely resolved, or that the villain they were fighting was sort of a bit ambiguous. And you had this guy called, you know, Tim Shaw, who was sort of the big blue bad they had, but I don't really think he was, you know, significantly interesting to kind of, you know, he appears in the first
story. Merit a return, let's face it.
He didn't really, but the Dalek did. The Dalek kind of, you know, she suddenly faces something which isn't, you know, she's called an alien psychopath, and there's no way you could negotiate with this Dalek. This Dalek is going to go to GCHQ Cheltenham, he's going to broadcast directly, the Dalek feet are going to come to Earth, they're going to kill everybody. That's it, you know. So there was a kind of precision, or kind of, you know, what's the word I'm looking for, Fiona?
Well,
leave
intent,
that hanging
yeah.
An intent there
purpose.
From the Dalek.
Purpose.
Yeah, a purpose
sense
there.
Of purpose.
Yeah, and a sort of a kind of black and white element. Not saying that's a very good thing, but it kind of the show kind of needed the Doctor to fight something which was less amorphous, and doing that, so that worked. The intent of the Dalek was very, very good, and Nick was very, very good doing the voice of it. And I kind, but the trouble is, as it went along, I kind of started wanting the Dalek to win. I mean, I was actually starting to side with the Dalek, because at least, you know, you knew where the Dalek was going, and there wasn't always sort of faffing about. And again, though I like Whittaker, she's given all these explanations, you know, long, rambling science fiction explanations, and you start getting irritated by her. You know, shut up! You know, she has a conversation with Dalek, and she has this kind of tone, and she has this kind of, you know, word salad. And you eventually, I think I'm siding with the precision of the Dalek, and away from the sort of like the chaos of the Doctor. Does that make sense?
It's classic underdog. It's what we were talking about with
classic
the football.
Underdog.
You want the underdog to win.
Yeah,
you
yeah,
can't
I,
help
I,
it.
Yeah, that's right. I kind of thought that. So I think that, you know, that Dalek particularly, I sort of liked him, and I wanted, he would have been a great regular villain, wouldn't he? You know, and there was a lovely kind of precision to him, but
give him a spin-off.
Yeah.
Get a web series around that Dalek.
Yeah.
And
there you are.
That sums up the whole thing. So finally, marks out of 10 then, Alan?
Well, I give it 2 marks. You know, I'd say that, you know, half of it was 10, and the other half it was 4, and the half of it was 10 had the Dalek in it. It's driving along the car, in a car 103 miles an hour, and the death stuff had, you know, Ryan's father in it, who, again, wasn't a bad actor, but you had this long, long scene of Ryan telling his father what he should say, and it wasn't interesting. We didn't care, you know, and it came in, you had this great scene in going, beating music, whacking along the you know, weaving in the traffic. I say Dalek's driving, going to Cheltenham, and then said it cuts to this long scene with him trying to talk to his father. And you just, I want to see what Dalek's doing. I want to see where he's going. I don't want to see this conversation. And I've never even seen Ryan Sauer before, so it wasn't a case of where it'd been set up. Fiona was saying that with it's hackneyed idea that, you know, it's called fridging, is it? You know, your wife is killed in episode 1, and then your motivation for the rest of the series is your wife, and occasionally she will turn back, come back as a ghost or whatever. I mean, this has been done over and over and over again, and it's a bit sexist. But it did work. So when Grace dies in episode 1 and she turns up again in that episode in Norway or whatever, it thematically worked, because you've been introduced to the idea, and it was sort of like kept on the ball throughout the episode, went through the series, and that was a thread. But with Ryan Tarver, we had heard he'd left him, but, you know, he just wasn't a presence, was he, Fiona? And
no.
When he turned up, we didn't care. when Graham answered the door, saw him and closed the door again, what's the audience felt?
Yeah.
Wouldn't have made such a great scene, but, you know.
It's strange, because all of Graham's lines, and all of Graham's, the guy who plays, what's the name of the...
What, Bradley Walsh?
Yeah, I mean, he's a comedian and an actor, and I don't think he ever puts a foot wrong. I don't know whether he rewrites his own dialogue, or everyone just writes for him well, or he just has this kind of, you know, this kind of precision about him. But, you know, he is, I cannot fault that guy, you know, and they're all good actors, but for some reason, he's the one who gets all the good scenes. And poor old Whittaker gets all the exposition scenes, and she just sort of drowns in them. Years ago, there was William Hartnell went along to one of the readings. It was for Galaxy 4, and he said, "I think I can do this entire scene just going mmm." And the director, writer wasn't very happy about that, and the director wasn't happy about that. The producers threatened to sack him, and there was a huge fight at the time. But 1 year along down the line, Patrick Trayton takes over, and he's in Peridon, and he does an entire scene just blowing into his recorder. You know, and he would say, "This is a huge description of stuff, I'm not going to do it. And I'll pass those lines out between, you know, the two companions, and they can ask any questions, and I'll just answer by blowing into my recorder, and they'll get more in it." And that's how he did it, you know. And Tom Baker, if it was Tom Baker, he would basically take that scene, and he'd say, "Okay, I need to say that line or that line," and he would basically pre-sit down and make it work. Whereas I think poor old Whittaker is attempting to do it. Do you know what I mean? She's presented with this wall of text, and she just tries to blast through it. And I think that's the wrong approach, because it just, you know, everything grinds to halt again. And it starts you, I mean, does she irritate you when she does this wall of text thing? Or is it just me?
I find it irritating. It doesn't bug me quite as much as when Tennant did it, maybe because she's a bit less ferret-like. but it does... It kind of just makes me sigh, you know, because quite often these expositing things aren't really needed. You know, you can more or less get what the point is from the scene. And, I think they generally, they slow things down, ironically, despite being gabbled out so fast, and they slow things down further because you're constantly stopping the replay to find out what she actually said.
The ever final thing is that there was stuff that was explained, and there was ever stuff which, you know, wasn't explained,
mm-hmm.
and really kind of
mm-hmm.
needed something, or mm-hmm. was avoided being explained
yeah.
because it was so stupid.
Yeah.
So in other words, you know, this Dalek is cut up,
yeah.
and the bits of a gun or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, is then all put together and survives 1,100 years,
mm-hmm.
and it ends up in an archive in Sheffield.
Mm-hmm.
That's a coincidence, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And then she knows where to go, or Dalek knows where to go, and it picks up the bits and pieces and puts them in the back of the trunk. We see the gun, we don't see other things. We've got to assume that other bits are there as well. And then it goes off and builds this
mm-hmm.
this new Dalek, which isn't which is obviously made out of, you know, bits of tin or
mm-hmm.
water butt or whatever, because it isn't like the one that appears in the picture, which is a new series Dalek. And you have to say, well, so all this technology survived. I mean, okay, dark technology is magic, but it survived, you know, 1,100 years. And that archive also contained missiles.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, there was something recently, wasn't there, where they found at Western Supermare, I believe they found at Western Supermare, an exploded bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And you immediately send the bomb squad, and they would probably have blown it up if it had been a real bomb. You know, you don't think, oh, there's a...
If only we could actually sort of bottle the magic of Fiona Moore and Alan Stevens and actually launch that as a precursor to...
They need a podcast.
They've got it, actually. It's already there.
Ah.
You also go to caldorcity.com to find out a whole heap of other goodies. But now the time has actually arrived where I need to ask you, Rachel, to put those last two questions to Fiona Moore and Alan Stevens.
Have you enjoyed your time this morning with us?
I think I didn't get two scoring. One was 10 and one was 4, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So average of 7.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. 6.5.
Yes, it was fun.
Okay. Would you come back again?
Oh, yeah.
That's what we like to hear. You know, 2019 can rejoice and celebrate the fact that we have actually gone through, as you said, TV psychologist Donna Dawson, the fabulous travel writer Harry Wallop, still like that name. Yes, tomorrow, of course, is Sunshine Saturday. Football correspondent Chris Hollins and Mark Hill talking about the giant killing. And we all love a good giant killer. The Mumsnet founders Shazad and
Muzmatch. Not Mumsnet.
You're quite right.
Completely different.
Yeah, I don't know.
Finding love online if you are from the Muslim faith.
Exactly. And, of course, to Fiona Boer and Alan Stevens, who wrapped up the things simply perfectly from that point of view. That's it, Rachel. We've wrapped up the program up completely. You set for 2019?
All set, yeah.
And see you again in 2020 when Doctor returns.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I think we'll speak before then, Alan. I mean, the fact of the matter is that's essential. I mean, how else can we keep up to date with what's happening in the Forest of Dean, or indeed Staines, you know, without having our regular correspondence from that? And you know, the Canada theme keeps on going, so all sorts of reasons to actually work through that. Plus, of course, we may actually, in November this year, be hopefully looking forward to Telefancy Society 3,
mm-hmm.
although who knows? I mean, these days I have it scheduled for the 14th of November or thereabouts. What's going to happen?
Mm-hmm.
What's going to happen with that? It's a different world entirely. Keep on keeping on. And have we got any more Caldor City things in the pipeline, Alan, that you want to give a quick plug to?
Well, the only thing I'm doing at the moment, I'm doing Celestial Toy Room for February, aren't I? And I've just done this cover, which I've managed to convince Paul Winter we can actually do in colour, which is of Paradigm Daleks all on fire, smashed up, which Phil Stevens very kindly, I bought these model Daleks off internet, and he's, you know, strategically broke them up and then put in, you know, painted it and all that stuff, and that's destroyed by the Destroyer from Battlefield. Remember
which is even more wonderful. Driving Ambition, of course, is out now from Bundoran Press by Fiona Moore, and Rabbit in the Moon has recently been acquired by Chizine Productions.
Yep.
Excellent.
I was at the Christmas parties for both publishers over the holiday, and everything is going great.
That's what we'd like to hear. And we will finish off this piece by simply asking you to say, Happy 2019. A one,
happy
a two, three.
Happy 2019!
days turn to years, I could never say goodbye to the sadness in my eyes. You know I could never.